fighting what's been called a shadow war for decades. But that said, on June 12th, Israel launched airstrikes on Iran, targeting a nuclear facility. There were high-ranking military officials and scientists that died as a result of that strike. And then since then, it's been back and forth attacks. The IDF said about 100 missiles were launched towards Israel, most intercepted by its Iron Dome system. But the exchanges have continued for days. There have been deaths on both sides, and there, of course, have been a lot of injuries. United States calling for an immediate ceasefire and surrender on the part of Iran. Will they weigh in even more? We'll find out. But as we watch tensions continue to rise, the impact on Western countries, I wanted to bring someone in who could help us understand the bigger picture. This is no stranger to our show. We've had Ralph Nernberger on the show before. He's a former foreign policy assistant for the United States, a member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee too, Georgetown University professor and senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Ralph Nernberger joins us by phone this morning. Sir, thanks so much for taking the call.
It's always a pleasure, Evan, to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
So 1 week in, maybe I'll just give you a chance to give us some opening thoughts and comments on this conflict between Israel and Iran.
Well, the conflict has existed since 1979, when the Shah was overthrown and the mullahs took over, Ayatollah Khomeini at the time. And they have called death to Israel, death to America ever since. What Israel is most concerned about is Iran developing nuclear weapons. The reason that the timing of the attack, as you mentioned in your lead-up on June 12th, is that Iran is in a weaker position now than it has been possibly ever, at least in the modern era. Iran has been using proxies around Israel for attacks, and virtually all of these proxies are either gone or weakened. Just to go around Israel's border, Hezbollah has been substantially weakened. Its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, was killed. Most of their missiles are gone. In Syria, they supported the Assad regime. Assad is now living happily ever after in Moscow, and the regime is now taking a more pro-Western stance. Continuing around, Iraq is not capable of doing attacks against Israel. The Houthis in Yemen are also weakened. Most of their missiles have been taken out. And obviously in Gaza, whether you like or don't like what is going on there, Hamas is not in a position at this point to be helpful to Iran. Finally, the largest backer of Iran potentially is Russia, and they are bogged down in Ukraine. Last April, the Israelis and Iran had a minor skirmish compared to today, in which Israel took out the Iranian missile defense system, so that basically Israel now controls the skies. So Netanyahu has been claiming that Iran will develop nuclear weapons in 2 weeks. He's used the 2 weeks or 2 months explanation for years. It seems that 2 weeks take a long time to arrive. Felt that this was the appropriate time to attack Iran. So with that as background, we're now at a critical moment to decide. Israel was able to take out most of the Nantes and Isfahan nuclear facilities. They have not been able to attack Fordo, which is located in a hill over 300 feet below inside the mountain. They do not have, apparently do not have the capability of doing this from the air. So it is now a question of what the United States will do. Mm-hmm. Will the U.S. join with Israel? Will the U.S. just give Israel the 300-pound bunker buster to take out Fordo? And all of this is now resting on the head of Donald Trump.
Well, and that's a good segue into the next question, Ralph. Ralph Nernberger is my guest, a former foreign policy assistant for the United States. I'm curious to know if your thoughts on what the U.S. will do is different given the fact that President Donald Trump is in power. Historical response to a situation like this versus the response today, do you think it will be similar?
It's very difficult to know. In fact, Trump, who often issues contradictory statements or contradicts himself after saying something, this time contradicted himself in the same statement. He says, I don't know. I may attack. I may not attack. I may help Israel. I may not help Israel. Well, that doesn't leave us with a great deal of certainty as to what is likely to happen. It does appear that the decision will be his. He has been ignoring most of his advisors, Tracy Gabbard, who heads the defense, intelligence agencies, said that Iran was not developing nuclear weapons at this point. And Trump says, I don't care what she says. So he is very much enjoying being in the limelight, which is what he always does. And he said the decision will be made maybe 1 second before it actually happens. The U.S. is not left with very good options. Trump wants to be on the winning side, always, and he wants to be the leader of the winning side. He made an odd comment yesterday or the day before saying, we now control the air. Well, who is we? The Israelis control the air, but the U.S. is not there. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he is conflating himself as part of the Israeli effort. Obviously, if the Israelis are successful, he wants to get the credit, because he always wants to get the credit. So he's now faced with a series of choices. The United States can provide the bunker buster bomb to Israel, but they also need to provide planes, because Israel doesn't have the capability of dropping such a bomb. In that case, will U.S. pilots be in those planes? Will the Israelis learn to fly them and use them? Will the U.S. Be willing to send ground troops if necessary? Netanyahu has been calling for regime change, and you can't change a regime from the air. So we don't know what is happening to the people of Iran. Are they willing to overthrow their government, and do they have the capability? So we're really at a very critical point in Middle East and world history.
I was going to say, Ralph, is it too much? Is it overstating it if we look at this as we are standing on the doorstep of a third world war? Is it that big?
I'm not sure if third world war, but it is that big. For example, Iran, even a weakened Iran, can close the Straits of Hormuz, through which about 40% of world oil travels. If that happens, the supply of oil around the world will go down. The price of oil and gas will skyrocket. The impact on this on economies throughout the world, including in Canada and the United States, is enormous. The Iranians probably do not have the capability of attacking the United States per se, but they certainly have the capability of attacking American facilities in the region. So that can expand. Russia and China are watching this very carefully to see what the United States will do. And should the United States get involved in a ground war, Russia will say, stop criticizing what we're doing in Ukraine. You do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So it has global implications.
There's been a bit of a groundswell of people within the Republican side of government in the States that are urging the president not to wade into this war, not to get American troops involved. Will that hold water with the U.S. president?
I don't think so, because it's fascinating to watch what's happening in the Republican and the MAGA world. They are divided between those who want to take stronger actions and those who do not. This was in very brief summarized in a debate last night between Tucker Carlson and Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. Cruz saying that he wants to have United States force involved, and Tucker Carlson saying he doesn't. Republican members of Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene being one, said stay out of this, and Republican members of Congress saying go in. And you're finding the same split on the Democratic side, where there are a number of Democratic senators and congressmen and leaders saying it is time finally to ensure that Iran does not have nuclear weapons, and others are saying let's not forget what happened in Iraq in 2001 or 2003 when President Bush W. Bush decided to involve American troops in regime change, and that has led to years of confusion within Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Ralph, we're almost out of time. Can I squeeze in two quick questions? One is simply, what role can Canada, should Canada, does Canada, or any of the other Western allies realistically play in this situation, whether it's mediation or supporting a resolution?
Probably very little. Obviously, they can provide their views to the president, but a good example to answer your question is when he met with the G7, he says, I don't need to talk to you about this. I'm going home, and pulled out. Now, he didn't want to talk to them anyway, and he Zelensky of Ukraine was there, and he didn't feel like meeting with him, and so he used this as a good excuse to leave. So I don't think the views of Canada or other allies are going to sway Trump in his whatever the decision-making process that goes through in his mind will take place.
Right. I'm not surprised to hear you say it, but asking the question and hearing the answer solidifies in my mind what I was thinking. Before I let you go, you regularly do talks for the Smithsonian. We're going to have you back this summer to talk about a talk that you are doing on. Tell us what this discussion is.
Well, it's a talk that all of your listeners or anyone else can zoom into, and I will provide the link. The talk is entitled Two Countries, One Border, and it is focusing on U.S.-Canadian relations from 1774 to 1815, and it underscores that Canada did not want to be part of the United States going way back then. Prior to the American Revolution, the Continental Congress in America invited the province of Quebec to join with the colonies against Britain, and they got three answers. It was the same word, no. And then Benjamin Franklin went up to Canada to try and convince them, and they said no. So when the war broke out, the United States, or the colonial army under Washington, invaded Canada to say, please join us, and they beat back the invasions. And during the War of 1812, again, the United States hoped that Canada would join the United States against Britain and said no. And so what we're seeing now in the current discussion of whether Canada should be a 51st state, which I don't think is going to happen and shouldn't happen, none of this is new. Mm. And so I will be looking at it from a historical perspective.
Well, I look forward to that. Hey, I appreciate you joining us, Ralph, as always. Incredible insight into what's going on in the Middle East. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much, as always.
Ralph Nirenberger, former foreign policy assistant for the U.S., sat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and pretty much gives us a history lesson every time he's on the show. You're listening to 980 CJME and 650.